Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Space Jams podcast. I am your fantastic host, Jim Murphy, and today we have a very special guest, a couple of gentlemen from the Naval Research Laboratory. You know, we've had a couple of them on, and it's very exciting. We love to hear about what they're doing in space and all sorts of things, and we're happy to have them on the show today. We'll give a brief introduction. A group of astronomers recently announced they've measured the size of a neutron star, an object on the verge of collapsing into a black hole. They've studied this star using NASA's NICER telescope on the International Space Station. Well, joining us today from that team is team member Paul Ray, PhD, to tell us a little bit more. Paul, how are you doing?
I am great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We're so excited to have you on. We've been trying to set this up for a couple of weeks now. It's always exciting once we finally get meet face to face with wonderful scientists like yourself. I like getting to talk to people that know more than me and know a subject that I know nothing about. It always makes me excited. Now, you know, neutron stars, kind of an awesome topic. And, you know, I know like the basics of neutron stars and stars in general, but, you know, I think, you know, maybe we should talk a little bit more about like your expertise and maybe provide some background on what, you know, you're doing exactly.
Sure. Yeah. So, well, just, I guess, background on me. So I'm an astrophysicist here at the Naval Research Laboratory, and I lead a group of other astrophysicists, and our primary focus is the study of these neutron stars. And neutron stars are, you know, like you said, they're on the verge of collapsing to a black hole. They're the most dense form of matter that we know outside of a black hole that are still in the universe, haven't collapsed down to a singularity. And so they're really exciting, interesting objects, and we study them with a number of different telescopes. The NICER telescope that was what you just mentioned, but also we study them in gamma rays with Fermi and with radio waves with a number of telescopes on the ground, radio telescopes. And so we put all that together, and our group studies many aspects of these systems. And I guess maybe you wanted to hear also about where I came from. So I have been at the NRL since 1995 when I came as a postdoc, so a long time now. And before that, I got my PhD in physics at Caltech in Pasadena. And prior to that, I was an undergrad in physics at the University of California, Berkeley. And so I've, you know, been doing this for a long time, and we've had a lot of great successes, and it's culminated now with these two spectacular satellites in orbit taking data and providing us with just a lot of fun results to talk about.
Yeah, well, from what I hear, you're an extreme underachiever. Right, you should probably get on something like a life goal or something you want to achieve, you know. You know, you got a lot of good stuff in there. We are originally from Pasadena ourselves, you know, that's where this all thing started, so that's kind of cool.
Oh, great. Yeah,
we've had a couple of NRL people, and we've had a couple of Caltech people, and we look at like exoplanets, and we look at just astronomy in general. So that's been, it's been kind of cool. But nice. The space world's very interconnected, which I do love.
It is.
Now, I'm just gonna start off, we're in a tangent already, but you're talking about, you have two satellites that you're looking at? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. So one is a free-flying satellite, Fermi. It's a gamma ray space telescope. And it's been surveying the sky in the gamma ray band since 2008. And so it's been up a long time now, and it's completely changed what we know about the gamma ray sky. You know, prior to Fermi, I don't know how many people know about gamma ray astronomy. It's a pretty obscure field, but prior to Fermi, there were only a few hundred known gamma ray sources in the sky, cosmic sources of gamma rays, which are the very highest energy form of electromagnetic radiation of light. So they're extremely high energy light, very difficult to build detectors for them. and they're kind of like kind of a particle physics experiment in space. And it's gone from having just those few hundred sources that we knew about from the prior mission called the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which ended in 2000, I believe. Yeah. And now we know more than 3,000 gamma ray sources. So we incredibly increased the number of gamma ray sources. And one of the reasons that's interesting is that a large number of those new gamma ray sources turn out to be pulsars, that is powered by neutron stars. And so that's led us, you know, studying our group working on the Fermi satellite has led us down this path to discovering lots of new pulsars. And that we want to understand them in all different ways. And one of the ways is to look at the X-ray emission from them, which is another form of electromagnetic waves or light, but that's at lower energies or longer wavelengths. And that we use this NICER telescope for, the Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer. And it was specifically designed to study X-rays from neutron stars. It's optimal for that task. And it is mounted on the International Space Station. And from that perch, it observes a lot of these neutron stars. And we do a lot of different physics with that instrument. So those are the two space-based instruments that we use the most right now. There's a host of other ones that we call in when we need them, NASA and the Space Agency have missions. There's Japan has missions. So we use a lot of different missions that are built by different countries, but the two that we primarily use are Fermi and NICER.
That's pretty cool. So just last week we were talking a little bit about the Da Vinci mission to Venus, and we interviewed some people from that team. And we were talking about spectroscopy. Is this in the same realm of spectroscopy? Is this also that, or is this something different?
Well, we do spectroscopy in these higher energy bands. The spectroscopy is a little different than it is for the lower energy bands. You know, people are familiar with spectroscopy from, say, a prism or a diffraction grating that spreads the light, into its different constituent wavelengths. In these higher energy bands, X-rays and gamma rays, we don't disperse the light in that way, but we detect each individual photon and we measure each individual photon's energy. So we can construct a spectrum out of many, many photons that we detect and their energies, make a little histogram, and then try to understand, you know, what it is we're seeing in the spectra of these sources.
Yeah, that's incredible. It baffles me that something like a photon, like my brain can't even understand how you get information from that. And I don't know if it ever will. I still need to really look into that. I'm like, this thing is so small and it's almost incalculable, like to the brain. It's like a million, like I can't even picture what a million things is on the ground or anything. It's the same way. So it's kind of incredible. And so the beauty you're talking about, you're working with, you know, ESA and JAXA both have different missions, kind of like that. They have their own telescopes. Are you working in tandem with the astronauts in the International Space Station, or is this a automated kind of satellite that you can function from the ground?
Right. Yeah. So ours is completely automated. We did not make it human rated. Because that requires a whole host of extra safety precautions and things like that. And it wasn't something where it was feasible to make our instrument like human serviceable or anything like that on orbit. So whenever the astronauts come out to do extravehicular activity anywhere near us, we close up and don't move so that we don't end up injuring anybody. but we try to keep the astronauts apprised of what we're doing. They're always very interested to know what science is being done from the space station. So we send weekly updates to them with pictures of what we're doing, you know, graphs and new sources we've discovered and things like that to keep them up to date on what we're doing, because certainly enabled by what they do, even though we don't directly employ them in operating our instrument.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, the Reliance and the International Space Station, you know, it's such a big part of space right now.
There's actually one really cool thing that we're doing, which is that the Japanese operate an instrument on the space station on one other part of the space station called MAXI, which is a X-ray all-sky monitor. So it's just looking at the whole sky and looking for new sources. And they're working on now a connection between Maxi and NICER that uses a laptop on the space station. So the laptop will get the data from Maxi directly, and when something cool goes off in the X-ray sky, can immediately send instructions to NICER to go and point at it with its huge collecting area and characterize it. And so that is a project that's being led by the NICER PI, Keith Gendreau at Goddard, and it's called Oh Man, the on-orbit hookup of Maxi and NICER. And that'll be really cool because it's like taking advantage of the fact that both of these instruments were on the space station, but they were operating totally independently before. And we had to get email from the Japanese to say, hey, go look at something. And we've, you know, set up our observing and go and observe it. But now we'll be able to do that in a really fully automated way.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible. And the, you know, the international cooperation is so big in the space community because there's so much stuff going on. And there's everybody's got something else up there and they're all doing something different. So it's huge, like for the sake of science, they were all helping each other out. So that's awesome. Now, yeah. You know, you got the NICER going on. Is that the only mission that you're working with for NASA, or is there anything else you're doing?
Well, no, we've always got things at different stages. Besides these two operating missions, I lead a study for a possible future mission we call STROBE-X. And it's like taking what we've learned from NICER, the technologies that were developed for NICER and for another European mission called LOFT, putting them together and making them like 10 times bigger. And so it'll be like a next generation super X-ray observatory. And what we're waiting for is that's been proposed to the NASA and NSF fund these decadal surveys. I don't know if you've heard of them. There's decadal surveys of astronomy and astrophysics, where every 10 years, the whole community gets together and submits proposals and white papers, and come out with a report that prioritizes what's the critical science to address over the next decade, and what are the instruments that will be able to achieve that, you know, make that possible. And those recommendations are actually set to come out within the next month or two for setting NASA and NSF's priorities over the next decade. And so we're hoping that they prioritize missions like the one that I propose called STROBE-X. And of course, that's a very, very long process to come up with ideas like that and put them in these 10-year surveys. And so space missions, we always have things at different levels of, in their development process, things that are just ideas like this, or smaller things where you're developing a technology and you might fly it on a small mission or a CubeSat or a small space station mission or something like that, to larger missions like Fermi, that's a $600 million gamma ray space telescope. So we have things at a range of different scales.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I think the idea, you know, that you, a lot of being a space scientist, time is not your friend, I think. Like, a lot of things take a lot of time, and, you know, especially if you're going somewhere, it can take a lot of time to get there. And right. So that's always something to worry about. And we've talked about that countless times on here, but it's super interesting. Now, specifically with the NICER observations and everything, talking about black holes and neutron stars, like, why? I think the best question, I always ask this one, it's kind of tough, but why, we'll come back to it. We'll start with, what's the difference between a black hole and a neutron star? Like,
sure.
Yeah, let's start there.
Yeah, it's critical that, you know, to know, to set the stage for everything. So, massive stars that are 8 or 10 times as big as our sun, when they burn out, their cores collapse, when they have no more nuclear fuel. You can only generate so much energy by fusing nuclei together, which is how the sun is powered, of course. And eventually they run out of fuel and their core collapses. And what happens is that for stars of a certain mass, about 8 or 10 or so times the mass of the sun, the gravity is strong enough to actually cause it to be favorable for the electrons and protons in the matter to combine together to form neutrons. Now there's much less, there's not electromagnetic pressure holding it up. And so it collapses all the way down until basically you've got a ball of neutrons pressed one up against each other. It's kind of like a giant atomic nucleus. It's got the core that is left behind when that happens is about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, but it's compacted into a region that's only about the size of like Washington DC Beltway, or you know, just say, you know, 12 or 13 kilometers in radius. So really small. So an entire sun collapsed into that tiny ball. And that's basically what you get when you press neutrons one up against each other into a giant sphere. And that's a neutron star. And of course, when that happens, you know, you're collapsing something big down to something small, just like by conservational angular momentum, like when a ballerina or a skater brings in their arms, they spin faster and faster. And so these are incredibly fast spinning balls of neutrons that are like a giant atomic nucleus, and the densities that are in the core there are more dense than any other place in the universe and more dense than we could ever make in a laboratory experiment here on Earth. So that's a neutron star. And if the star is even bigger, then the gravity of the mass of all the material is so much that even the pressure of neutron star, neutron against neutron, is not enough to keep the thing from collapsing. And it collapses all the way down to, as far as we understand, a singularity, a point. And it's enshrouded. We can never see what it is because it's enshrouded in an event horizon where not even light can escape. So they're completely dark in the sense that nothing can come out from the inside, which you'd think for someone that observes would be very boring because you never see anything if no light ever comes out. But in fact, they're really dramatic and exciting because they tend, if they're near another star or other gas, they can, that material can spiral into the black hole. And of course, it's got a super deep gravitational well. So the energy is really, really high. And so material spiraling into it releases a ton of energy. It makes really big, exciting fireworks in all different wavelengths, but X-rays and gamma rays and radio waves, particularly. And so study of black holes is very exciting. They're just not individual isolated black holes, which would be extremely dark.
That's incredible. So there's kind of those stages of deterioration of a star that goes, and it's specific for each star. Like you kept saying that the, you know, stars that were bigger than ours. So what would happen to our star? Like, let's just say, you know, in the future when she's running out of gas.
Yeah, right. So we're in an intermediate kind of state where we can't, our sun won't burn all the way to the very highest elements, you know, won't make iron much in the core. And what happens is it, when it collapses, because it's so much lighter, it doesn't, the electrons and protons don't get pressed together to form neutrons. And so basically you're pressing atom against atom as tightly as you can. And that ends up being a star called a white dwarf, which is bigger than a neutron star. Instead of being the size of a city, it's the size of the whole Earth. So this, you imagine something that's about the mass of our sun compacted into something the size of the Earth. So indeed very dense, but not nearly as dense as a neutron star. And it just starts, it's called white dwarf because the ones we see are really, really hot. And so you see these very hot stars that just continue to cool during their lifetime. And what they blow off the outer envelope, they form a red giant, and they blow off the outer envelope and leave behind some very pretty astronomical objects like planetary nebulae and things like that.
Interesting. So there's the star that goes to the white dwarf that goes to the red giant. And then does that become like a supernova, or is there?
The supernova is powered when that collapse happens from the basically the white dwarf stage to the neutron star stage. So it only happens for the more massive ones because that's a huge amount of energy release when it collapses to a neutron star. And that's what powers most supernovae. Well, there's multiple types of supernovae, I should say, but the core collapse supernovae are powered when something collapses from the white dwarf that's basically at the core of a massive star down to a neutron star. If you're not big enough to collapse that neutron star, it never makes a supernova. But white dwarfs are what power classical novae.
Gotcha. Okay. Very cool. Very cool. Interesting. Yeah. I think I never really knew the difference between a neutron star and a white dwarf. That's super helpful. I always kind of thought they're all kind of maybe like a different name for the same thing, but that's super helpful.
Right. Yeah. So it's planet size, city size, point size.
There you go.
White dwarf, neutron star, black hole.
I love it. Love it. Yeah. So now the more difficult question is, why are we studying these neutron stars? And also, like, how, you know, why should a regular person care that we're studying them? I think right. those are kind of the important questions.
There's a lot of exciting reasons why we study neutron stars. Like I started to say, they have some of the most extreme conditions we can ever make in the universe. So they allow us to study extremes of physics that we couldn't access any other way. So not only are they super dense, and so we can study the highest densities in the universe, but they accelerate particles to incredibly high energies. They have super strong magnetic fields that are whirling around. And they're incredibly good clocks. So they're spinning hundreds of times per second in many cases, and they blink. And so if you imagine putting a really precise clock in an orbit around another star, you've got almost exactly what Einstein would have thought of as an experiment for relativity. And so we can use them to test predictions of general relativity by watching these clocks orbiting in the space-time of some other body. And we can see effects that are only predicted in general relativity that are huge. I mean, many of these effects have been observed in the solar system, but they're teeny tiny and very difficult to measure. Whereas in these neutron star systems, they can be huge. And so we can look for deviations from general relativity to see if we can understand what's going on with gravity at these scales. So those are some of the reasons why you might study them for fundamental physics purposes. But then there's also astronomy. You know, they are a part of the life cycle of stars. They are, you know, members of our galaxy and, you know, affect how the galaxy works. They power super bright gamma ray bursts that we see from across the universe when two neutron stars spiral in together. So they're very important for many different aspects of astronomy. So they're totally fascinating objects. So we've got physics, we've got astronomy. Why are we doing them at the Naval Research Laboratory? Well, one, of course, the NRL is very interested in basic research. That's a fundamental thing to have a top level basic research lab within the Navy so that we have a talented scientist doing things here. But also, you know, ever since the beginning, the Navy has been very interested in precise timekeeping. And, you know, for originally it was shipborne clocks to be able to measure your longitude. And then the developed the GPS initially. And now the Navy maintains the atomic time standards at the US Naval Observatory that has all of our time. So the Navy has sort of operational responsibility for our celestial coordinate frames and for very precise timekeeping. And so we at NRL are looking at these other sources of very precise time, these neutron stars that are spinning hundreds of times per second. They're just a big ball. They're very inert. So they're really, really good clocks. And you can use them to define independent time standards and to measure where your spacecraft is independent of GPS. And we're always thinking about, well, what happens if you're not able to access GPS for whatever reason, going out very far from where GPS is, or starting to operate out to the moon and beyond. What if, you know, GPS is disabled or inaccessible for some reason? Can we use that? And so one of the cool things we have at NRL is being able to do basic research, but also keeping an eye on what sorts of applications it might have for, you know, for our defense systems.
Yeah, that's incredible. We were talking a little bit a couple of weeks ago about GPS and satellite and how a couple, you know, different countries are coming out with their own type of GPS,
right,
and everything, and how the world is changing and countries are becoming more independent in space. It's pretty interesting to go forward and kind of, yeah, there's always that security concern, which is always a part of space. So it's interesting that you guys, obviously being a part of the Navy, are involved in that.
Yeah, so, we rely on space for so many things. Making sure that all of our systems are as resilient as possible is critical.
Yeah, I don't think people understand how important space, you know, exploration, whether it's just scientific or, you know, has an actual, you know, person-to-person purpose. They don't understand like how important it is, all this stuff, but right. I hope we can teach them. That's the key. Yeah, so we got this telescope on, I believe it's a telescope on International Space Station, NICER. It's a big gamma ray telescope, and it's studying neutron stars. So how do we study these neutron stars? What do they like look like inside? What are they made of? And, you know, let's get into them a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah. So NICER is indeed an X-ray telescope, and it's it has concentrating optics. X-rays are difficult to reflect because and most times they hit the surface, they are either absorbed in it. But if you make a mirror, these are gold-plated aluminum mirrors, where the X-rays come in very grazing angle, they can reflect. And so NICER is made up of many of these aluminum foil optics that are nested and concentrate these X-rays down onto a detector. And so what we do is we point all these optics at a particular neutron star we're interested in and collect all those X-rays and try to see what they're telling us about it. And ask, what's going on at the core of the neutron star? And the answer is that we don't really know what happens at the core, because they're at twice the density of an atomic nucleus. And the nuclear physics to understand what's going on down there is just not well known. The theory is too difficult. And so there's a number of different theories about what happens down at the core of the neutron star as they're pressed together. Do the neutrons stay solid and just keep being pressed against each other and keep the star from compressing too far? Or is the star more squishy? And that would happen if the neutrons start to break up into their constituent quarks, or if other exotic particles are formed down at the core. And then the neutron star is more squishy. So we call that a stiffer or a softer equation of state. So how stiff is it? And previously, no one had ever been able to measure with any accuracy the radius of a neutron star, because remember, it's something that's about 13 kilometers in radius, and it's thousands of light years away, or hundreds of light years away at minimum. So it's a really difficult measurement. But with NICER, what we're looking at when we see the X-rays from it are really hot spots on the surface of a neutron star. So there's particles that are accelerated in the magnetosphere, and they come raining down on the poles of the star, just like particles that are in the Earth magnetosphere rain down on the poles of the Earth and create the aurora. Mm. So everyone's familiar, many people are familiar with the aurora. And so that's the kind of thing we're seeing, except that we're seeing the hot spot where that particles raining down is made on the neutron star. And because they're so compact, they don't just emit like a bowling ball that's painted. The photons that are coming off actually bend through space, because the GR is so strong, the gravity is so strong, that the paths are curved, and you can actually see around behind a neutron star, because the light would go and bend down and hit the backside of a neutron star. And so by modeling that effect, we can measure both the radius and the mass of the neutron star, and then tell how squishy it is. Because some theorists will have a prediction for a particular model, say, I think if it's 1.8 solar masses, it should be this big. And we can compare our measurement to their theoretical predictions and start to rule out some theories and favor other theories. So that's the kind of measurements that we do with NICER when we're trying to understand what's going on at the core of the neutron star, is really taking very deep observations and trying to model what's going on with the emission coming from these hot spots.
That's awesome. The idea that neutron stars are bending space is so cool. I mean, and I think when, a lot of people are, there's talk about like dark matter now, like what is the space where there's nothing? And people are trying to figure that out. And my answer for everyone right now is simply like, what permeates everything is like gravity. The gravity is kind of the fabric of space and time, and it kind of holds everything together. That's like the best answer I can give them right now. And, they always use the example of you have a, like a sheet, and you put a big, heavy, like a bowling ball in it, and you toss stuff around, and kind of you can show orbits and things. I love that. And it's so hard to conceptualize, but it's like an awesome human experiment just to think about it a little bit and try to wrap your head around it.
Indeed. Yeah. And that is a good analog of it. That's sort of, you take your two-dimensional sheet and distort it by putting weights on it, and then it curves like that. And, the way I always like to think about it is, I think Wheeler said it was that space matter tells space how to curve, and space tells matter how to move. And so you put all that together and you've got this coherent theory of mass bending space-time and then space-time causing matter to, you know, cause, making gravity. And right now we can't really put that together into one theory that explains gravity and quantum mechanics. So what goes, you know, the stuff that's happening at the core of the neutron star or whatever doesn't match with our theory of gravity because we haven't been able to make a quantum theory of gravity. And so that's something that we're looking out for the future as theorists try to put together, figure out what is the right theory of everything.
That's, you know, the questions that aren't answered are always the most fun to contemplate. And that's what, you know, that's what keeps people like you getting into space. You know,
right.
Questions that you can't answer. And it's like, how the hell am I going to figure this out? And that's the beauty of it. And I can't wait for, I love when those things come out. Super yeah. Cool. So what's next? What's nicer looking at right now? Like, can, if you look up in the sky as a regular person, can you see neutron stars? Can you see little dots up there? What's nicer looking at and what's it going to look at in the future?
Yeah. Nicer is great in that it's extremely flexible in what it can observe and how it can reprogram its thing. So we, you know, so it observes a number of different sources every day. Most of them are neutron star sources. Some are black holes, sometimes other things like stars that are active in X-rays or things like that. But right now they're following some really a new magnetar that was discovered. These are neutron stars that have super strong magnetic fields, like, 100 times stronger than what we typically find in pulsars. They're following up a bunch of different sources, and most of these neutron stars are not visible in the night sky. They're interesting objects because they're so energetic. They make these X-rays and gamma rays, and the particles that emit those X-rays and gamma rays make radio waves, but they're very tiny and they don't make very much light, optical light. So we don't normally see them in the band that our eyes can see. A few of them have stars as companions. If they're in a binary system around a star, you can see the star. Mm. But generally, they're not something that you can see with optical telescopes or with your eye. And that's why the study of them wasn't really possible until we could get to space.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first neutron stars were discovered by the first rockets that had X-ray detectors on them. Some of those were captured V2 rockets from the Germans back in the 50s. And doing, you know, people using them for science instead of for war. And NRL was involved in a lot of those early research of flying sounding rockets with Geiger counters on them effectively at the beginning to see what was out there. And they found the first neutron star, which is still the brightest source known in the sky, called SCO X1.
Yeah, wow. That's great. I mean, the captured V2 being used to figure this stuff out is like poetic justice for the Earth. I don't know who said it. It might have been Von Braun. He said the rocket performed perfectly. It just landed on the wrong planet. And that's pretty cool. I love that stuff. So, you know, after this is over and people are now hyped up on, you know, neutron stars and they want to learn more, where can they go to figure out some more stuff about neutron stars?
Yeah, NICER has a great webpage. It has a lot of things I would encourage people to check out because you can see videos that kind of illustrate those points. And you can even see what NICER is doing now and, you know, in real time. And there's videos of it operating on the space station, which is cool. So that's at nasa.gov/NICER. Super easy URL, just nasa.gov/NICER. And then also on Twitter, NASA posts a lot of our interesting science results on this @NASAUniverse. If you just follow that on Twitter, that's good. And, you know, find your favorite science podcast to listen to and you'll hear about it. We're always trying to get the word out, but I'm glad if people are excited to follow up.
There we go. Yeah. All right. Good stuff. Great. All right. Now we've gotten through NICER and we've gotten through black holes and neutron stars, whatever, who cares? Okay. But you, my friend, we're going to get more into you. And one of the questions is, we love knowing about this stuff. Did you always know you wanted to get into astrophysics? Did you always know you wanted to be a scientist? How'd you get where you are today?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't know I wanted to do astrophysics. I guess I always knew I wanted to do something in science. My dad was a biologist at UCLA. And so, you know, you have to rebel somehow. So I never took any biology courses. So I rebelled by going into physics. And I was on a track to do physics and did physics undergrad. And I thought I would do particle physics, actually, was what I was kind of aiming towards. When I got to grad school, I was interested in doing very highly computationally intensive stuff because I really liked computer science. Mm. So I was looking for an application of computing. And back then they were doing very computationally intensive calculations of quantum chromodynamics. And I thought I would do something like that. But then I met a professor who said, well, you know, we've got these new parallel supercomputers. And one of the things that they can do is Fourier transforms, which are looking for periodic signals in data. And we can do them really long. And the kinds of periodic signals that we're looking for are these things called pulsars. And I didn't know what those were, but I was interested in the computational task. And so I started working with this professor, and it turned out that we did great stuff making the longest Fourier transforms that you could do. Back then, doing a billion point Fourier transform was a big accomplishment on a supercomputer. Now your phone can do it easily. But it was a big accomplishment back then. We started finding these new pulsars. And so I got really hooked on that. And then for grad school, spent a lot more time taking some astronomy classes and doing my PhD thesis on pulsars. Actually from Arecibo. You might know the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico is the one that just collapsed recently. Mm-hmm. I did my PhD thesis there, observing pulsars and then bringing the data back to Caltech on magnetic tapes on my lap in the airplane and analyzing them on computers back at Caltech. So it was a fun time and a transition to doing astronomy. And then I just kept doing more and more types of pulsar astronomy ever since my postdoc here, and then continuing the research group here.
That's awesome. Yeah, the Arecibo, you know, we were talking about that. That was kind of a shock, although people knew that, you know, the funding was getting lower and lower.
Right.
It was getting old. And I know they're trying to set up maybe a new radio telescope, like a bigger one or something somewhere, or they're talking about maybe doing one on the moon.
Yeah, there's a lot of efforts to follow up or do other large radio telescopes. There's people that want to use the site that Arecibo was for more radio astronomy because it's an important site and it's, you know, really important to the people of Puerto Rico who we, you know, relied on and made great friends with down there at Arecibo. But I mentioned the decadal survey earlier on, and that survey prioritizes the radio astronomy that we'll do in the next decade as well. And there are some very large radio telescopes proposed there for how we should spend our money in the next decade to do the best possible radio astronomy. And overall, radio astronomy has moved a little bit from the giant single dish telescope like Arecibo. Technology has changed, and now the trend is to do large numbers of smaller telescopes because they're much easier to mass manufacture, and the computing power that we have is sophisticated enough that we can combine the signals together and make the effect of a very large dish with other benefits and not necessarily have to make a really large dish. But you might have heard that the Chinese are taking a different tack, and they built an even larger version of an Arecibo type telescope called FAST, and China's 500 meters across, whereas Arecibo was 305 meters across. So they're going big on this large single dish telescope, which is a fantastic super sensitive instrument, and we'll probably do things like detect the first pulsar from Andromeda galaxy, and it's super sensitive. So it's really impressive stuff, but it's just a different tack than most of the people in the US are heading for the next decade.
Yeah, very interesting. And you said pulsar so many times, we got to figure out what it is exactly. Just maybe some people don't know. Could you explain a little bit what a pulsar is?
Yeah. Sorry, I should have said that more clearly earlier. When neutron stars are formed, like I said, they spin really fast because they collapse to being small. They also have very strong magnetic fields. And so they're spinning. And those magnetic fields have accelerated particles in them that create beams of radiation. And when those beams of radiation sweep past us, we see pulses. And so most of the neutron stars that we know of as pulsars. They're pulse sources of radiation. They were first discovered in 1967 using radio telescopes. We now know a few thousand of them as radio pulsars. And we know a few hundred of them that pulse in the gamma ray band and or the X-ray band. So a lot of them emit high energies as well. But most people for pulsars, they think of radio, pulsing radio sources.
Oh, gotcha.
They're all neutron stars.
Cool. Nice. All right, there you go. So neutron stars, a lot of the times being pulsars helpful.
Yeah.
We're breaking it down here a little bit.
Yeah, so. Right. Sorry, there's a whole zoology of all the different names for these things. But
oh no, yeah, that's the fun part. I think people like to get it all down and have it said to them.
And to dispel one thing that I get a lot is people think the quasars and pulsars might be like kind of close because they both end in R. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Pulsars are, you know, neutron stars here nearby in our galaxy. Quasars are supermassive black holes all the way on the other side of the universe that are super strong sources of radiation, but they're totally, totally different. No real relation of them at all.
Wow, there you go. All right. The yeah, there's a bunch of different stuff in space. Gosh, they're all, you know, but it's nice to have someone to tell you what is what, and you're doing research and you're like, I'm not sure if I got this completely. It's nice to have some reassurance, so that's good. Yeah, well, the other thing, you're our third guest from the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory that we've had on the show, and we love having the people from there. They're great. They're always wonderful and help us out, and they make me look good. So that's always good. How is it like working there, and how did you start working there?
Yeah, I mean, it's NRL is great. It's I started there right out of grad school as a postdoc. And so I did, we have a really good postdoc program here, if anyone is interested, come to work. And you get to meet people at the lab and see whether the lab is a good fit for you. And then at the end of my postdoc, I got hired on as a research astrophysicist. And it's different than a lot of my colleagues. Most of the people we work with are at universities, of course. Most astronomers work at universities or professors. It's different because my job is effectively 100% research. I don't have any teaching responsibilities or anything like that. Mm. So it's exciting. We do a lot of research. We have a lot of good facilities. We have a cluster here of people that are experts in all different things. You know, if I need a space technology expertise, we have a whole Naval Center for Space Technology here. And so we have access to a lot of resources and some resources that our university colleagues don't have access to. The DOD flies the space test program to allow us to fly instruments that, you know, other people wouldn't be able to access. And we have computing resources that are DOD resources and things like that. So we bring a little bit different set of things to the, you know, overall basic research game. And of course, we are always looking out for those interesting applications. And sometimes we get funding from the agencies that are thinking, hey, that technology might work for us, you know. Our group develops detectors, these X-ray detectors, and people in our group flew many satellites in the early days, and you know, things happen. Like one of the, one of our early satellites that was observing the sun from space found radiation increases every once in a while, and it was determined that those were actually from a Soviet nuclear reactor that was flying in space. And I was like, wow, you know, that's pretty exciting. So a lot of the same detectors that we use end up being useful for other things, like because we're sensitive to nuclear radiation and various things like that. And so the pretty interesting story is there's, you can read about that one, and there's a Science Magazine article on that. This was back in the 80s, I guess. Now it's a long time ago, but yeah, so we have different, slightly different priorities and slightly different goals than our university colleagues, but we both work really, really well together.
Awesome. Yeah, no, that's great stuff. And I love the different applications. You know, it's always good to be a Swiss Army people. It's always good, or Swiss Army objects, really, you know, figuring out different things. You know, that's awesome. Now, yeah. We just got two more questions for you. There are classics. Are you a science fiction guy yourself? Books, movies, anything?
I do enjoy science fiction, especially as a young person. I was really into like the kind of hard science fiction stuff. There was a book by Robert Forward called Neutron Star, which, you know, captured my attention as a kid, long before I ever knew I would do anything related to neutron stars. But, you know, they had worked out the, you know, sort of a physics realistic civilization evolving on the surface of a neutron star and stuff like that. Yeah. So that was fun. I read a lot of Larry Niven, you know, who wrote Ring World and stuff, which was kind of a version of a Dyson sphere around stars. And so, yeah, I was interested. And I mean, and more recently, it was fun to read like The Martian,
Classic. Like, that's everyone's.
So, you know, yeah, it's just fun. Yeah, like solving problems, getting stuff done, using science.
Yep.
So yeah, I enjoyed those kind of things.
Awesome. Sure. Yeah. Well, we've got the Martian before from a Naval Research Laboratory guy as well.
Okay.
We haven't gotten the other ones, and I think you're the first person to mention Dyson Sphere on the podcast. So that's pretty cool. So that's awesome. That's great. Now the last question, how do we get the younger generation excited about space? Is it through answering, you know, difficult questions? Is it through science fiction? Is it through just seeing, you know, getting people to see some things up in the sky? How do you think we should be doing that?
Yeah, I think, you know, capturing their imagination is exciting, and science fiction is definitely a way to do that. Fun books and movies. And I also think that people just need to understand science and not be fearful of it. You know, not everyone needs to do scientists. You don't have to become a professional scientist to be able to think like a scientist and evaluate evidence and, you know, construct your understanding of something and be willing to change it when the evidence changes. And if people could just, you know, be a little more critical in their thinking, it would be really helpful. So I think we can do that by teaching people how we work as scientists, you know, how we use the scientific method and how we find, you know, some of these neutron stars will come up with a theory about how they work and then it doesn't match the data and we change our mind. And so teaching people how to apply the scientific method and that everybody can think like a scientist would definitely be valuable.
Fantastic. Yeah, firsthand experience, science is terrifying. I'm like, I don't even know what's going on. And then once you start getting some concepts down, and then math comes into like, right. And I'm like, oh gosh, there's so much we got to understand. But yeah, no, I think that's awesome. I like the emphasis on the scientific method. I think that's big just for disseminating all kinds of information just in your everyday life. So that's really good. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know, we're running out of time here, but that was kind of all the questions we had for you. But we got to say thank you so much for coming on and teaching us a little bit about neutron stars and, you know, saying the word Dyson Sphere, different things like that. But it's been such a pleasure having you on. You got any words of wisdom to leave us with? No pressure.
Gosh, no, it was my pleasure to be on. It was great. And just keep on being curious and asking questions about science, and we'll always do the best we can to answer.
There you go. Well, there you go, everybody. Everybody, please excuse my wrinkled shirt, and I hope everyone enjoyed having Paul, and if you can also see other Paul on the show today. But, you know, also follow us on Instagram at SpaceChams, and if you're hearing this, you're either listening to it on Spotify or watching it on YouTube, so you already know where it's at. Ask us more questions. We love to answer questions, and we can find people that can answer the questions. I love trying to field them myself. It gives me something to research, gives me something to do. Paul, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot. It was great.
And everybody, just remember to keep looking up.